You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush held a press conference this evening where he restated the claims Secretary of State Colin Powell made before the U.N. Security Council yesterday and vouched for their authenticity. We will wait, he said, to see what terrorist states like Iraq can do with biological and chemical weapons. The game is over. We are determined to keep the peace. Peace Watch correspondent Jeremy Scahill was in Baghdad as Secretary of State Colin Powell delivered his address to the United Nations yesterday. We spoke with him earlier today for his impressions.
Well, this was the Iraqi government's official response to Colin Powell's 90-minute statement yesterday at the UN Security Council. And Dr. Amir Saadi, the special advisor to the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, as well as the Deputy Foreign Minister Saeed al-Moussaoui, addressed a absolutely packed room full of journalists from around the world. And there are actually two breaking news items that came out of that press conference. The first, and perhaps the biggest piece of news, is that for the first time since the weapons inspectors returned to Iraq, an Iraqi scientist is being interviewed alone by the weapons inspectors. He is not accompanied by any Iraqi government minders or escorts. This is something that the U.S. had been criticizing for several weeks now. The Iraqis now say that scientists are coming forth and saying they're willing to talk to the weapons inspectors outside of the presence of Iraqi government officials. But Amir Saadi, the advisor to Saddam Hussein, did say that they are very concerned that whatever their scientists say in there is going to be twisted, particularly by the United States. Now, the second news item that came out, Verna, is that there is a delegation of European Union parliamentarians here. Today, they were taken by the Iraqi government to two sites that Colin Powell cited as being as housing Iraqi weapons programs or support programs for prohibited weapons programs. So that is the breaking news right now.
Well, the scientists, actually, Colin Powell made a pretty big deal out of the fact that no scientists had actually been allowed to, or they were strongly discouraged to meet alone with the inspectors. And they went on to, he presented a case whereby one scientist, a visit to his home, revealed a lot of documents and computer equipment that they said was damaging to the Iraqi government and to Saddam Hussein. So what do you think spurred the fact that these scientists are now speaking with the inspectors? Was it as in direct relation or response to the fact that Colin Powell made this case yesterday?
Well, it could very well be that, Verna. I also think that, you know, the scientists in Iraq for many months now, ever since the United States pushed to have that clause put into Security Council Resolution 1441 that was passed last November, that scientists could be taken out of the country with their families to be interviewed. Some people called it the forced defection clause. Iraqi scientists have been very nervous about that, and so they've been trying to stay under the radar. I think now that the Iraqi government is realizing that their time is running out very, very quickly, and so I would imagine that they have encouraged scientists now to actively cooperate with the weapons inspectors, and by cooperate, that would mean outside of the presence of government officials. So I think that there is a part of this that is the Iraqis attempting to build up their standing with most members of the Security Council. This gives the French or the Russians or the Germans something to go forward and say, look, the Iraqis are doing this now. So I think that we're seeing 11th hour moves now by the Iraqi government that are intended to try to shift public opinion toward their side.
Jeremy, as a journalist who's been living there in Baghdad off and on for the last year or so, did you see any signs that that President Saddam Hussein had discouraged scientists to participate with the UN inspectors' teams?
Well, senior Iraqi officials have said on a number of occasions that to participate in anything that would help America would be treasonous. And for the senior officials of this country to make statements like that would certainly send fear into the hearts of many. But they haven't directly threatened any scientists that we would be aware of. Now, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but I think also the scientists are sort of getting hit from both ends, because they're being threatened with essentially being forcibly taken out of the country to be interviewed on the one hand, and then are going to be under a great deal of pressure if they cannot verify to the Iraqi government that they didn't say certain things or that they did say certain things. So what I would imagine is that these Iraqi scientists are going to request that all interviews that they do in private are recorded and that they be provided with a copy of the tape themselves. But, you know, Verna, this is a very tightly controlled society. People, including journalists, only get that information which the Iraqi government wants us to see.
Some of the so-called evidence that Secretary Powell provided were actual, were allegedly actual telephone conversation, wiretap intercepts between officials within the Iraqi army, I would imagine. What kind of reaction was there? You said you were with the Ba'ath Party at the time that the Powell speech was being heard.
Yeah, when they played three tapes that were, according to Powell, allegedly conversations between Iraqi commanders, one of them at least within the elite Republican Guard. Now, when the second one of those tape recordings was played, laughter went up in the room, not just among the Ba'ath Party members or those people that speak Arabic, but also among the camera people who are Iraqis, because what they said is that the accent on the tape was so exaggerated. It was so such an exaggerated Iraqi accent. One savvy Iraqi observer said that it was like the old Saturday Night Live skits where Jim Belushi was doing the excessively Chicago accent, and they said that this is a fabrication that any third-rate intelligence operation could put out. And tonight, Dr. Amir Saadi said that it was the kind of conduct not befitting a superpower, taking a jab at America's intelligence operations.
Well, that's interesting. The Washington Post is basically considering the case in an article here on the front page. They say that the case laid out by Secretary of State Colin Powell yesterday included virtually every element of the lengthy U.S. indictment against Iraq, combining an unprecedented release of U.S. intelligence with familiar allegations pointing to what he called Saddam Hussein's web of lies.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, Verna, I watched this very, very closely, and I've followed this issue for many years now, and I can say that there was very little new in what Colin Powell was presenting. A lot of it was regurgitated allegations, unsubstantiated allegations based on what Colin Powell repeatedly said, quote, our sources. The U.S. clearly does not have a smoking gun. And one of the things that was pointed out at the Iraqi reaction press conference today is that Colin Powell was selectively quoting Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei. And the Iraqi officials who were holding this press conference had the transcripts of the testimony of Blix and Baradei just around 10 days ago or so when they testified before the U.N. Security Council, and showed how Colin Powell was quoting one sentence that was convenient to U.S. to the U.S. position, and failing then to continue on with a sentence that was giving Iraq credit or was more supporting the position upheld by France and many other countries in the Security Council and indeed around the world, that the inspections process should continue. Now, another thing that we've learned is that members of the European Union delegation did in fact meet with the weapons inspectors today. And out of that meeting, we understand that the weapons inspectors are saying that, yes, indeed, they want more time to work on this, that they believe that they can take care of the job, that 2 months is not long enough, and that they were, in fact, disturbed by several of the things that Colin Powell said. In fact, the Iraqis are saying that Colin Powell himself violated Security Council Resolution 1441, which said that all member states had to give over any intelligence that they had or evidence that they had that Iraq was in possession of any weapons of mass destruction or that it was intending to produce them. So by withholding this information, if people take at face value what Colin Powell said, and now seeing it yesterday in that 90-minute presentation, that would mean technically that, in fact, the United States has violated Security Council Resolution 1441, i.e. the U.S. is in violation of Security Council Resolution 1441, which is binding at the U.N.
In other words, if he had all this evidence, why was it not submitted to the inspector's team prior to yesterday?
Exactly, and I think what the weapons inspectors are saying, we hear this via the European Union delegation that met with them today, is that Colin Powell is essentially, on behalf of the Bush administration, trying to use them as pawns in a war game, essentially, that is being played between that the United States is imposing on Iraq right now. So I think that is what the Iraqis are trying to do. But I also have to say, Verna, that this was not the swift counteroffensive that one would have expected from Iraq today. In fact, it was a very dull response that they issued. It was full of some technical matters. Some parts were interesting. The Iraqis did some concrete rebutting of what Colin Powell said. But quite frankly, they didn't rise to the occasion. They did not put any of their more eloquent senior spokespeople forward, such as Naji Sabri, the foreign minister, or Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, instead relying on the people that appear at the regular press conferences. So it seems as though Iraq is relying on the fact that world opinion is against this war right now, and they don't appear to be taking the propaganda war all that seriously, at least as was evidenced tonight by their press conference.
Peace Watch correspondent Jeremy Scahill speaking with us from Baghdad. In 1991, investigative journalist Martin Yant wrote a book called Desert Mirage, the true story of the Gulf War. In his book, Yant details some of the lengths the U.S. military went to control media coverage of the war against Iraq. Soldiers physically threatening reporters and photographers and limiting access to the battlefield were just a couple of methods employed in order to keep the media and American citizens from seeing or hearing the truth. Yant suggests that the first Bush administration thought if the public knew too much, support for the war might disappear. Andrew Stelzer from KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon, spoke with Yant about his book, Desert Mirage, and how the government might interact with the media if a war is again declared on Iraq.
At the time that the book took shape, I was writing a number of columns for the Columbus Dispatch, at which I was commentary editor at the time. And even though there was tremendous support for the war, I was getting more response to the columns I wrote on the Persian Gulf War than anything I had written in the 10 years or so that I had been writing columns. And that spurred me on into greater interest. I knew that at least a certain percentage of the people were very, very concerned. And some of those people turned out to be conservative Republicans, one of whom had been one of Richard Nixon's Watergate lawyers. And he had lunch with me to express his dismay on how public opinion was manipulated to such an extent that he said he found that, as a conservative who distrusts government, very frightening to see that the government could whip up such a fervor over a war with a country that most Americans knew nothing about before August 1990.
Now, you talked a little bit about reporters being led around by the nose, and that brought to mind the press pool system, which was utilized in the first Gulf War. That was a system in which the press was basically under control of the military. I'm going to read a few quotes from your book. This is from a New York Times reporter, Malcolm Brown. He said, "Each pool member is an unpaid employee of the Department of Defense, on whose behalf he or she prepares the news of the war for the outer world." An AP reporter said, "I've covered wars for 25 years, and the first time I'm held prisoner is by my own military." That's Mort Rosenblum from the AP. We have another AP reporter saying, "In 20 years, the only nation I've found to be more restrictive, and not much more restrictive, was Iraq." From Time magazine, Stanley Cloud said to the Washington Post that asking questions about the pool system was like asking whether a smoothly functioning dictatorship is working well. Even Walter Cronkite, later in your book, these are mainstream media. Could you talk a little bit about the pool system and what that did to coverage of the first Gulf War?
Basically, reporters had no free access. They were totally controlled and had media manipulators with them. And there was a quote from a Pentagon plan that kind of sums it up. It says, "News media representatives will be escorted at all times. Repeat, at all times." And that is essentially what happened. And they had very little way to get any independent information. That's why I say that in my introduction to that book that it was really easier to cover the war from here than it was from there, because at least you could have access to more disparate media, including the media in Europe, whereas the reporters out in the Persian Gulf were very, very limited in what they had access to, and everything was being controlled by the Pentagon.
Now, you currently write for the Columbus Free Press, In an article you wrote for the Free Press, I believe it was last year, you talk about some of the many important stories that get ignored in the American press, like the pre-9/11 warnings of terrorist attacks, U.S. training and financing of the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, and the fact that the Bush family and bin Laden were essentially business partners with the Carlyle Group. Now, these are all major stories, and in the U.K., in Europe, and in other countries around the world, these stories do receive appropriate coverage. What is it about the U.S. media that is unique and that these stories are not getting covered? Is it patriotism? Is it fear? Is it government censorship? What's going on here?
Well, it's a combination of those factors. Unfortunately, the news media have become more and more dependent on the information disseminators. There have been cutbacks, particularly in foreign reporting staffs, by virtually all of the major U.S. news organizations. Because what has happened is that you now have very few corporations owning major portions of the news media. And those major corporations, unlike the newspaper publishers of the past or the network founders and original stockholders who had a great commitment to a free press, the commitment of these large corporations is, first of all, profit. Some of that even started back in Persian Gulf War I, as I point out in the book, that NBC, which at that time owned General Electric, would not allow some kind of report about General Electric, or the effectiveness or non-effectiveness of something that it had built for the war.
So why do you think that newspapers and TV stations didn't pick up on that story?
Most of it, I really think, is self-censorship caused greatly by a lack of aggressive reporting. One of the justifications for the war was Saddam Hussein had massed his troops on the south side of the Kuwaiti border and was prepared to invade Saudi Arabia. And only one news organization had some doubt of that and bought some satellite photos of the region. That was the St. Petersburg Times. And those photos showed that there were no Iraqi troops massed on the Saudi border. That was a complete fabrication by the Bush administration. Saudi Arabia was under no threat at all. Saddam Hussein had never threatened Saudi Arabia, and there was never any evidence that there was any massing of troops in preparation to invade Saudi Arabia, and that was the biggest thing that President Bush, one, used to justify our military buildup there. Well, things are now worse with this current crisis, starting with the war in Afghanistan. The United States bought up all commercial satellite time, so no media organization can independently buy satellite photos. The United States government controls all commercial satellite photo-taking capabilities. So we can never, no media organization can now buy photos and use them to prove or disprove anything that the second Bush administration says. The only other satellite photos available are owned by governments, mostly by far the United States government.
Is there a chance for some sort of mainstream media revolt, or is everybody just too concerned about their jobs to really fight back about the censorship?
There was all this complaining after the fact, and the press pushed the Pentagon into a new policy on the handling of the press, but now Rumsfeld has thrown that out and says he's not going to follow that, so that was all an exercise in futility. And we now have a new breed of reporters, I mean, and certainly there are exceptions, that are going to have to learn it all over again, and after it's all over, they also may be saying, we've been had, just like they were in 91. It's, to a great extent, a different group of people, and they're going to probably have the same complaints after the fact, and they're going to be used, so far they've been used quite a bit in the last year and a half, and it probably won't be until after the war on Iraq's over and things come to some kind of real crisis point that all of a sudden the press will start saying, wait a minute, we've been used again.
Martin Yant, author of Desert Mirage, speaking with Andrew Stelzer of KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. First Lady Laura Bush had scheduled a symposium at the White House on the poetry of Emily Dickinson, Langston Hughes, and Walt Whitman, and invited several noted poets. Sam Hamill, founder of Copper Canyon Press, was one of the invited poets. Hamill not only declined the invitation, but called upon other poets to write poems in opposition to the impending war in Iraq. Subsequently, the symposium scheduled for February 12th was canceled. Peace Watch spoke with Hamill yesterday about his letter to the First Lady and what motivated him to decline her invitation. And today, as promised, we share his poem, State of the Union, along with poems from other artists against the war, read by Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian and editor Lona Elias.
I have not been to Jerusalem, but Shirley talks about the bombs. I have no God, but have seen the children praying for it to stop. They pray to different gods. The news is all old news again, repeated like a bad habit, cheap tobacco, the social lie. The children have seen so much death that death means nothing to them now. They wait in line for bread. They wait in line for water. Their eyes are black moons reflecting emptiness. We've seen them 1,000 times. Soon the president will speak. He will have something to say about bombs and freedom and our way of life. I will turn the TV off. I always do, because I can't bear to look at the monuments in his eyes.
Countdown to war. My dreams are filled with dead children bodies piling up in the Middle East. I see their smiles, their future that could have been. I see the broken hearts of their mothers and fathers, and I cry while I sleep now. While awake, I see headlines carefully constructed by the mass media. Countdown to Iraq. Who owns the media? Who wants more children to die? For oil? For greed? For land for the chosen few? Who are these chosen few? Are they me? Are they you? Can I remain awake, or is life becoming a living nightmare? Can I look myself in the eyes and knowing that I am just standing by while the world is falling into the abyss of darkness deeper by the day? Do we dare risk anything for our fellow brothers and sisters that are suffering in our world? Do we dare be heroes and not just sit by as the bullets and missiles rain over the Palestinian children? As the children in Afghanistan die like flies this winter? As the children in Iraq wait with fear in their heart about what will happen next? Can we really sleep without seeing their bodies feel our dreams? The eyes, the smiles that will be no more. Do we dare be heroes? Or will we watch our world be crucified again in fear of love in fear? The choice has never been more clear. What do you choose? By Birgitta Jónsdóttir from Iceland.
My radio. I lie on my narrow bed, turning a magic knob. A stranger's voice at my head surrounds me with a mob of the living and the dead, the wounded scream and sob. 10,000 miles away, how uselessly I pray. Their midnight is my day, where other slayers slay. The words and gunfire blending, what messages are they sending? 1,000 lives are ending. By Virginia Adair, 90-year-old blind teacher and poet from California.
Thanks to the multi-talented Peace Watch staff, editor Lona Elias and producer Scott Gurian for the reading of the poems. Poet Sam Hamill, founder of Copper Canyon Press, is also author of 13 volumes of poetry, has taught in prison for 14 years, and worked extensively with battered women and children. Finally, tonight, we present this musical segment from the radio satire group, the Christmas Coup Comedy Players, at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York.
Blackmail, terror, and mass murder. That's just the way it is.
Psycho killer.
We will bring violence and terror, and we will destroy the Iraqi people. That's just the way it is. We're keeping them on the run.
Run, 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 run away.
In 2 years, America has gone from a sense of democracy to the ambitions of conquest in the Middle East. And this nation is leading the world in the man-made evil of international terrorism. That's just the way it is. This nation can spare the world from a plague of innocent people. A plague of innocent people, a terrible disease, the disease of democracy, the disease of oppressed people, the disease of their intentions and freedom. The full force and might of the United States military will destroy the ideology of the man-made evil of international democracy. Let there be no misunderstanding. America will not accept freedom. The best way is blackmail, terror, and mass murder.
Thanks to Scooter at KPFT and the Christmas Coup Comedy Players for that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance today from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Keith Shaljian, Reem Kathuda, Benta Berkland, Ron Pinchback, and Sidrak Franklin. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org. If you'd like to support this type of programming, and we wish you would, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, where you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.
Teacher!